Hi, this is Pete Link. We're back at churchandgospel.com and delighted to have you with us. Again, I've got Dr. Ed Gravely back with me. How are you, Ed?
I'm doing very well.
Well, that's great. Today, we want to talk about something that's near and dear to your heart. What do you want to talk to us about?
We're going to talk about, in this podcast and hopefully a few other podcasts after this, the history of the Bible.
Bum, bum, bum. And I think that's exciting because it's a big topic. We're not going to cover it all this time.
No.
But it's just kind of presumed that we know the Bible contains history, but there's a history of how we got the Bible. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, we actually teach a class here. It's a 400-level class for our Christian studies majors and whoever else wants to take the class called History of the Bible. And there's a variety of ways you could teach a class entitled History of the Bible. But what I like to do is I like to begin with what I sort of call the foundations for the Bible. We don't spend a lot of time on it, but we talk about things like language, writing, materials, those sorts of things. And then we just work our way very briefly through about five topics in the Old Testament, about five topics in the New Testament, things like some dates, transmission, text critical issues, translations, those kind of things of the Old Testament. Then we do it again for the New Testament, and then we spend the last several weeks talking about the versions, the early versions of the New Testament and the Old Testament, as well as modern, and then try to move our way into to get to how did we get to the bookstore, the shelf in the bookstore is labeled Bibles.
Right.
How did we get from the New Testament to there? And of course, the King James figures prominently in the history of that.
In the English-speaking world, there's no doubt it has to, right? So so here's what I want you to do. What are you trying to accomplish for your students? What is the thing that you want them to learn if they take this class?
Well, there's a confidence. I guess that's the way I can. I guess if I had to pick a word, the word would be confidence. So what I have discovered over the years is that there's a tremendous amount of apologetic material that could be covered in a class like this, defending the Bible, defending the faith, defending the transmission of the Bible, and so forth. And we do some of that, but most of those issues, most of the criticisms of the Bible that you get on when you just listen to people in pop culture or you watch the History Channel, the Discovery Channel, most of those things, honestly, go away in light of just some decent information about how we got the Bible. And so, in fact, my former pastor and I did these series of coffee house meetings when the Da Vinci Code came out. The movie came out, and it was all about Da Vinci Code type stuff in the Bible and Christianity. And we had a great time, but what I realized even back then was most of the people who were leveling criticisms at the Bible didn't even have enough information about the Bible to formulate intelligent questions.
Right.
And so I would certainly, our students are not going to be sitting in the seat of the critical, most likely, but they will be hearing the criticism. And I want them to at least to be able to answer questions like, how long did it take for all of Paul's letters to be collected together? When was the Bible finished? When did the first non-canonical gospel show up? How has the Old Testament been translated? Because people will make all sorts of claims about those sorts of things.
The standard one is the Bible that we have today has been translated in language after language, and there's no conception of the reality of the manuscript evidence, is there?
No, and certainly not the role that modern scholarship has played on that.
That's right.
Absolutely.
So now we are going to do several podcasts on this topic. You're the New Testament guy, so let's focus on New Testament. You've got several categories that you take in this class to lead somebody through it. You said it's language, writing, collection, and the transmission.
Right. Those are sort of the four. When we think about the New Testament, how we got the New Testament, the foundation for the New Testament, those are sort of four material. I mean, there's obviously plenty of theological categories we could go through, inspiration, inerrancy, and those sorts of things. They've already been through that in New Testament survey. So we focus on the more material aspects of it, language, writing, collection, and transmission.
So let's go through the New Testament. Tell me about the language of the New Testament.
Yeah, it's an interesting topic. We now very readily and easily identify the language of the New Testament as what we call Koine Greek. Koine just means common. There was a period of time, though, in the history of the church where it was thought that the language of the New Testament might even be some sort of divine Greek that was specially formulated by God for the writing of the New Testament. That was a bit hyperbolic in its claim, but it was born out of the fact that for a long time, the Bible was the only real example of Koine Greek that existed.
Right. So Koine Greek stands in a line of the development of the Greek language.
That's right.
So before that, you would have had, what would you call, classical Greek?
Yeah, and its various dialects.
Yeah. And then, so what makes Koine so unique?
Well, it's where how it comes about in history is primarily a function of Alexander the Great. And when he organizes, and I use that word politely, organizes, extorts, cajoles, whatever you want, the Greek city-states into an army,
right.
That has a tremendous unifying effect on the language. And it produces a common alphabet, and it produces a common vocabulary. And over a period of several hundred years, when you get to Jesus' day, where it is the language that everybody speaks, it's funny. It's a language that is being spoken by everyone, but is virtually the primary language of no one, and right. So it becomes it develops into a fairly common set of vocabulary and grammar, and that's a dramatic oversimplification of how we got Koine Greek. But when you get to Jesus' day, you've got Romans who are speaking Greek, and you've got Greeks who are speaking Greek, and you've got Turks who are speaking Greek, and you've got Jews who are speaking Greek, and you've got right. Africans who are speaking Greek. So obviously. It's not going to be the language of Plato and Aristotle anymore.
Right. So in general, what we have is a language that's just like any other language. It's been affected by the circumstances of its use.
Right.
Modern Greek would be very different.
Yes. In fact, I joke with my Greek students that the class, when they do Greek 1, it's going to be, other than recognizing some of the letters, it's going to be of virtually no use to understanding modern Greek.
Well, and that doesn't mean that the class is not, your Greek is not
no.
useful.
But in the same way that, you know, the folks who've had English class, when they tried to read Chaucer, Middle right. English, and there's a whole lot more years passed between Koine Greek and modern Greek than there is between us and Chaucer.
That's exactly right. Now, what about the category of writing of the New Testament?
Yeah, now that one's a really interesting one. We have this, we imagine that ancient people wrote on scrolls.
Not iPads,
no. Okay. And there is no doubt that that scrolls were part of the earliest transmission of the New Testament. But virtually every piece of manuscript that we have today, almost, unless it actually originated from a Jewish Christian community where they were copying the New Testament like the Torah scrolls, almost yeah. all of the pieces of the New Testament we have were not scrolls, they were pages out of books.
Right, and those books are called...
Yeah, we call that the codex, right? Our codices. And we know that they're what we call in textual Christendom, they're recto verso. In other words, they're written on both sides of the paper. Hmm. And so we know that it weren't scrolls that way because you don't write on the backside of a scroll. And so the primary way in which the New Testament was transmitted was in book form, almost certainly. Now, it is unlikely that the entire New Testament circulated as books. Early on, by the 4th century, though, that is the case. We have those earliest great codices of the 4th century, Codex Vaticanus and Codex Sinaiticus, and they're not just whole New Testaments. They're Old Testament and New Testament.
Right. So that's helpful because, you know, if culture had been built on these scrolls and then suddenly we go to codexes, or codices, how then, what's the impact of that upon, why would a codex be better? What are the implications of it being used?
Yeah, the codex is better just simply because it's more efficient. It's a more efficient way to transmit. One of the interesting impacts, though, that the adoption of the codex had on the early church was it forced them to think about the canon in a more rigorous way than they had before. So if you've got, I've got all these letters, I've got all these books, quote unquote books, I can put them all on my shelf. You go into my office, I've got plenty of books on my shelf. Half of them I don't agree with, but they're important work, so I have them there. But when you are starting to compile a book of the New Testament, then you have to think about things like, do I want to put, I've got this, the teaching of the 12 apostles, the Didache, we love that, it's great. Do we want to put it in the scripture? Well, no, because we don't think the apostles actually wrote it.
Right.
Or something that's near and dear to your heart, you have to even start thinking about what order are we going to put the books in?
That's right. Well, and I guess that's one of my larger points when you talk about canonization, whether it be old or new, is that the order of the canon... Maybe we can't find the original, but the order of the canon reveals how people read it and understood it.
Right.
It's very significant on where certain books end up. For example, if Hebrews is stuck in the middle of the Pauline letters, you know, for example, that that order suggests that Hebrews is a Pauline letter. But in the other orders, it's in a different place, isn't it?
Yeah, it's between it's between the Pauline letters and the general letters, and where the Pauline letters are largely in order from largest to smallest, and yet Hebrews is larger than Romans, and it sticks right there on the end. And that was it doesn't. Yeah, that was their way of not having to decide, I think.
It's, yeah, maybe up to punt, as it were.
Yeah, the school I used to teach at, we used to teach a series of classes in Pauline letter. We had a class called the Early Pauline Letters, and we had a class called the Later Pauline Letters, and then we had another class called Hebrews and the General Letters. And that was our way of not having to pick which category it belonged in.
That's right. And so that's helpful that we know that we go into this discussion of the collection, therefore, of the various parts of the New Testament. So here's the questions people always have. You're sitting around in 150, 200 AD. Are you going to have a New Testament as a codex or a scroll or anything lying around?
Yeah, that's a question. That's a complicated question. And I to be fair, my view on the subject is probably a bit more radical on the conservative end than most scholars would be willing to admit. So here's what we do know. We know that by the middle of the second century, for example.
So 150 AD.
Yeah, exactly. Around 150, there's only four Gospels. And we know this because all of the opponents, guys like, there's a Gospel comes along that's an attempt to harmonize all of the Gospels together by a guy named Tatian, and we call it the Diatessaron. And he was attempting to produce just one singular authoritative Gospel. But even the name, the Diatessaron, literally means, one, you know, by way of the four. And so, and you even have early anti-Semites, guys like Marcion, that are trying to sort of get the Jewish in. He thinks the Jewish influence has corrupted the New Testament, is trying to get it out. And in doing so, when he lists, get rid of this book and this book and this book and this book, but keep this one and this one and this one, he actually affirms for us that the early church there are only four Gospels. They are calling them the four.
Right.
And so there's the idea that other Gospels like Thomas or whatever had deep roots in the early church is not, that doesn't seem to be demonstrable at all.
Yeah, so I think that's important that we recognize that while they were not perhaps a New Testament codex lying around, you do have collections of a fourfold gospel.
Absolutely.
Four gospels stuck together. Was there order always Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, or was there some variation?
There's not a lot of variation. By the time we have codices that have the book, the Gospels in them, they are largely in Matthew, Mark, Luke, John order. Hmm. And that order is affirmed by Augustine. We call that even to this day called the Augustinian order. And it's stuck, but it is not the order in which most modern scholars think they were written.
Right.
the same is true though with Paul's letters. This idea, we have sort of a common sense notion of how Paul's letters came about. And the reality is that that common sense notion will also often lead you astray, simply because we don't understand how writing was done in the ancient world. And so, for example, we think, well, over a period of about 20 years, Paul wrote letters all around the world. Then Paul dies, his importance is recognized, and so the church then has to go through this period of recompiling his letters. So we've got a letter in Rome, and we've got a letter over here in Turkey and Galatia, we've got letters here in Greece, and it might take 100, 200 years to get them all back together, and we might still be missing a few, like the previous letter to the Corinthians or the letter to the Laodiceans or whatever.
Right.
But that's almost certainly not what happened. And we know that because we know that in ancient letter writing, the primary collector of the letters was the author themselves.
Hmm.
And so we have famous Roman orators, for example, complaining that they wrote a letter to their... Cicero, for example, writes a letter to a town council giving them some advice, and they lose the letter, and they write to him and ask him to send it again. And he writes a letter to a friend of his, and it's like a personal affront to his dignity that they would forget the letter, lose the letter, and all that. But then you turn the page in the Loeb Classical Library collection, and the next letter is the letter that they lost. And the reason why they wrote to him and said, could you resend the letter, is because they knew Cicero had a copy. Cicero was the collector of his own letters. And Paul was almost certainly the collector of his own letter. He even used an amanuensis, and so Tertius. And so he tells Timothy when he's in jail, you know, if you come before winter and, you know, bring me a coat and bring the parchments. Mm-hmm. And so when the best evidence, I think, points to the fact that Paul's letters were collected together almost at the moment of his death. And that's why the author of 2 Peter, which I take to be written relatively early, around the time of Paul's death, can refer to the writings of Paul. And it's why there is, it's not until 19th century German scholarship that you get any real dispute over trying to add lost letters or trying to claim that certain letters don't belong and that sort of thing.
So the final area that you wanted to focus on was transmission, which is, of course, we're talking about how the manuscripts themselves passed from, in essence, the author's hand into our modern hands. So give me kind of a breakdown of how you understand the transmission of the New Testament.
Yeah, so I begin with collection. And so I believe that the New Testament was collected very early. Mm-hmm. And there's other things that we could talk about that point to that. And apostolicity, I might have made that word up, but the apostolic nature of the books, either written by an apostle or connecting them directly to an apostle, like in the case of Mark and Luke and James and Jude, that very quickly we have a fairly fixed New Testament, very, very early. Now, there's trouble gathering some evidence for all the books of the New Testament very early, like, for example, 3 John. We don't have any early citations by the church fathers from 3 John, but that probably has more to do with the nature of 3 John than it does anything else. Ask yourself this: when was the last time you heard a sermon from 3 John in your church? And so that's the kind of thing we run into. But then what very quickly, because we have a very early canon, what happens then very quickly is the missionary movement takes that canon and runs all over the world with it. And that produces two things. Number one, it produces a great number of copies. Mm-hmm. We don't actually have a great number that have survived. But the fact that we have as many as we do that has survived is probably proof enough of how many there actually were.
Yeah, so that's an important consideration. We don't have all the data. We won't.
Right.
But we don't need it because the data that we have is indicative of, you know, what was happening, which is the missionary movement led people to take the gospel and therefore the Bible, and especially the New Testament,
right,
to other places. And other places have other languages.
Right. So what we end up with, that's exactly right. So what we end up with is we end up with two things. Number one, we end up with a large number of copies very early, mm-hmm, that are, and don't hear me carefully, that are inexpertly copied. And that doesn't mean that they're bad, that they're corrupt, but they do make the kinds of errors that happen in manuscripts that are being made by amateurs.
So the error is not in the Bible or in the Bible that we have.
Right.
But scribes, their work is not the same as a biblical author. A biblical author's work in forming a book is inspired, is inerrant, infallible, authoritative, and sufficient. A scribe copying a book, that is not a question of inerrancy. That is a question of a regular person, just like you, somebody say, well, what did pastor say about blankety blank sermon last week? Somebody asks you that and you try to explain it. Odds are you're not going to use the exact, get it exactly right every week that you would try to do that. So that wouldn't mean the sermon was wrong and it wouldn't mean that the text was wrong.
Right.
But that is what happens with any scribe. But with the New Testament, we don't have to worry about that because there are so many.
That's right.
Manuscripts.
And in fact, we do even get to see the scribes recognizing when another scribe made a mistake,
right,
in fixing it. And these aren't errors that change the meaning of the gospel or anything
Correct.
Like that. I think we've actually already done a podcast on this at some point. But it, what it does tell us, the reason why it's important to mention is because what it does tell us is that the New Testament very early was in the hands of missionaries.
That's right.
In fact, you called them scribes. That's being really generous. These are not scribes.
Right,
these are,
right.
They are technically scribes. But, you know, this is the guy who runs the grocery store.
Yeah, not the scribal class,
right,
as it were.
This is the guy who runs the grocery store who's got family in North Africa that he wants to get the gospel to. So he goes to his pastor and says, let me have a copy of the Gospel of Matthew. He makes a copy by hand, and he goes to North Africa and plants a church.
Right.
And so, but then the second, so there's that. Then the second thing that you said is true, and that is most of these places are, over the first couple of hundred, 300-400 years of the church, their Greek is losing its ascendancy as the lingua franca, as the language everybody speaks. And so what happens then is immediately when you get into these regional areas, everybody's translating their manuscripts into another language, into Coptic, into Latin, and so forth, into Syrian.
Yeah. So in what's happening there for us, though, is we're getting to see how those aspects of the early church, especially in a missions context, are understanding their scriptures. It's not perhaps not as useful as uncovering one of these old manuscripts in Hebrew or in Greek, but it is very indicative how it was read, and it's very indicative how powerful and how powerfully the New Testament as a text moved across the globe.
Yeah, and from the academic side, I mean, even modern scholars find those earliest manuscripts that survived in North Africa, primarily due to the climate, they find them to be among the most reliable.
And that is what's very helpful, is that as we take our students through history of the Bible, we do it to, as you said, help them confirm their confidence in the text.
Correct.
And, because that allows them to be the missionaries, the pastors, the faithful Christians that we know that God has called them to be. And that's why I'm excited that we're going to have a few podcasts here to talk about the history of the Bible, because we want you who are listening to also have great confidence in the Scriptures and in the inerrant, infallible, authoritative, and sufficient Word of God.
Yeah, and the very fact that you have a Scripture is certainly the supernatural work of God, but
that's
it
right.
was also the supernatural work of God in the church who were copying it and who were taking it around the world. I mean, it eventually made its way to America.
That's right.
You know, 1,700 years later or 1,500 years later. And I think that tells us a lot, that tells us a lot about how the story of the book of Acts, to take the gospel from Jerusalem to Judea and Samaria to the ends of the earth, how that actually worked out in the first centuries of the church.
And that's powerful, because we're fortunate that the gospel made it all the way here to Charleston.
That's right.
That's right. So, Ed, thank you for joining us yet again.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
And as always, we are grateful that you're listening to us here at our churchandgospel.com podcast. We're going to close off here, but we look forward to having you join us next week. Thanks.